It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm hosting solo today. My co-host Veronica Rickert is off for the holiday. Coming up, the key to leadership lies in cultivating virtue, according to our next guest. First, Thanksgiving traditionally kicks off the charitable giving season, and our next guest has some advice and inspiration for us. Lisa Dietlin is a philanthropy expert and author of Making a Difference, 365 Tips, Ideas, and Stories to Change Your World. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, and thanks for taking some time out of your holiday to join us. I appreciate it.
You know, I was actually telling Amanda I've escaped my family to do this, and I love it because it's a little bit quiet, avoiding the chaos of, and you got me out of, you know, meal preparation, so I love it.
Oh, good, good. Well, that means you're going to get stuck with dishes, though, so it's going to come out in the wash.
It does. It always does, doesn't it, Rob?
Yeah. Well, today's Thanksgiving. Tomorrow's Black Friday. A lot of people are thinking about shopping now, but it's also the kickoff of the giving season. You say there are some ways we can combine the two. How can we shop with charity in mind?
Oh, it absolutely is. There's many ways that you can shop with charity in mind. What most people don't realize, Rob, is that, you know, in these last 2 months of the year, 80% of the nonprofits raise 50% of their budget. And that's absolutely astounding. Here we all are waiting to the last 2 months when we're crazy busy with all the activities with family and holiday. But, you know, things that we do normally, like shopping, can incorporate a charitable component. For example, you know, many of us are sometimes repelled by the crowds at Black Friday, but I say take that money that you were going to donate to charity and maybe go in and either pool it with family members or friends and shop for charity. Instead of shopping for yourself, get those deals for charity. For instance, there's nonprofits that need coats for kids, or socks is a big item for many people. It's a key to good health, and especially good foot health for people that might be homeless or might have, you know, trouble getting clothing for themselves. So you could pool your money together and say, you know, instead of getting the deals for ourselves, we're going to get them for a nonprofit that needs a microwave oven, that needs a coffee pot. You know, there's a new domestic violence shelter opening in Chicago, the first one in 10 years. And, you know, they're going to need all sorts of items for those moms with kids that come into the shelter seeking, you know, a place of peace and comfort and also a little bit of home.
So you can still take advantage of those deals and have, I guess, the fun if you're the kind of person who finds shopping fun, but do it for a good cause. I am not that kind of person, by the way.
Neither am I. I was recoiling a bit this afternoon. My sister-in-law loves to go into the store shopping, and we were in, and she goes, I have to go back. This meal is just blowing my shopping.
Oh, no.
I'm looking at her. So she is one of those people, and I was like, oh, my gosh. But another thing that my mom and I like to do, instead of going to the big stores, we like to go to the thrift stores. So most thrift stores are run by nonprofit organizations. So you think about, we know about Goodwill and Salvation Army, but many, you know, animal shelters have thrift stores. I worked with a group out in New Mexico that had one called What the Cat Drug In. You know, looked what the cat drug in. And that was their thrift store. And you can find some really unique items there. We actually found for that same sister-in-law some champagne flutes that, you know, over the years had been broken, and they were hand-painted and from France, and we weren't allowed to use them anymore because we had broken them over the years.
You keep breaking them, right.
Right, and then my mom and I found some that absolutely matched that set in a thrift store. And so it's sort of, you know, you're putting on a different hat and saying, you know what, I'm going to recycle, I'm going to be green, we're going to reuse, I'm going to shop at a thrift store affiliated with a nonprofit organization. And so in many ways, you're supporting that nonprofit while still participating in the Black Friday, but maybe not in the mainstream stores. Another idea I'd share is the layaway angels. You know, about 3 or 4 years ago when the economy got really bad, Rob, stores, first of all, Kmart and then Walmart and others, started reinstituting the layaway model, where you would pick out items and lay them away, paying a little bit on them each week, each month, in the hope that by the holiday, you would have paid it off so you could get those items out of layaway. And some people just never turn for them in the time between when they put it in layaway and the holidays. And people took advantage of that and said, you know what, I'm going to be a layaway angel. I'm going to go in and say, I want to put $50, $100 on a layaway for someone so that they have a nice holiday. And
wow,
my family actually did that last year. And my brother was in charge, and he went. And the first store, they didn't have anything. But the second store he went to, It was a Kmart, and they said, absolutely, we have a layaway. And he said, could you find one with kids' toys in it? And the clerk did. And so we put money toward their layaway, and the clerk was so excited. She said, I know this family. I know they're going to be just amazed that somebody came in and paid off their layaway. And this was on Christmas Eve. So they had a really nice holiday because of what we did. And we don't know them, and they don't know us, but we paid it forward.
Hmm. Now, getting back to the idea of shopping for a charity, is there a way to make sure they actually need what you're giving them? I assume a lot of charities would hate to have a bunch of unnecessary stuff showing up at their door.
That's a great question. Yes, there is a way to find out. Obviously, you know, many nonprofits list their items, their wish list items on their website. They list, you know, what they need. Do they need coffee makers or microwaves or sheets or coats or jackets or jeans or, you know, pants for young kids? They actually list those items either for the clients they serve or maybe for the nonprofit themselves, that they're trying to save money budgetarily and that all the dollars raised in this time actually goes to the programs and that the overhead is covered by individuals providing those items. It could be coffee, it could be, you know, reams of paper or what have you for the office. But there are ways. If it's not on their website, pick up the phone and call and ask, you know. And I would call places like, you know, the Boys and Girls Club. I would call Big Brothers, Big Sisters, you know, organizations, you know, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, you know, especially in this time where we want to make sure that everybody's taken care of. I would also look at the senior centers. I'd look at those organizations affiliated with military personnel that sometimes are so overlooked in our country but have done such a tremendous amount of service. You know, call your local veterans hospital or call the DAV or the Veterans of Foreign Wars or the American Legion. Call those social clubs and see what's going on. Oftentimes, too, your Rotaries and Kiwanis in your community are doing something. So, yes, you don't want to buy a bunch of unwanted things, but you can make it a pretty safe bet if you're buying, you know, things that children need, meaning coats and boots and snow pants and mittens and hats and clothing, and finding the right children's organization or organization that focuses on helping children, you could make a difference.
A famous one, of course, is Toys for Tots. Can you talk about that a little?
Toys for Tots is a fabulous organization. It's been around, you know, about 65 years, and it has given almost to 200 million children, Rob, 400 million toys. And it's absolutely a fabulous program. It's also supplemented by the Toys for Tots Foundation. So if you're not in the mood to go out tomorrow and shop for the toys and, you know, purchase something and donate it to one of the barrels or actually take it to one of the offices, you can make a financial donation. Our First Lady right now, Michelle Obama, has been a chairperson for a number of years, and they're raising lots of money. Actually, last year they raised more money than the year before. So I think we all realize at this time of year that it's important to give back and to help others. And this is a way that even with your family members and your young children, you know, teaching them philanthropy, teaching the next generation what it means to give back to others is so important. And this might be a fun activity that, you know, have them go and pick out their favorite game and say, now we're going to give it to somebody who might not get this game, who might not have access to these types of toys like you do. And teaching them that gift of philanthropy would be a wonderful, wonderful gift that you would leave, a wonderful legacy.
We're talking to philanthropy expert Lisa Dietlin about charitable giving at holiday time and throughout the year. And you can join in. Where and how do you make donations of money or stuff? Or maybe you volunteer to help a nonprofit or other organization. Do something with your kids or your family or an organization to try to make the world a better place by helping people out. Call us and tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We continue our conversation now with philanthropy expert Lisa Dietlin, talking about charitable giving, charitable service, now during the holidays and throughout the year. You can join in. Who do you like to give money to? Is there an organization you'd like to put a plug in for? Who do you volunteer for? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls in just a few minutes. Lisa, first of all, though, let's talk about hunger. That's certainly on a lot of people's minds on this very food-based holiday.
It is. You know, what surprises me, Rob, is that we think so much about it in the November and December time frame, and yet people are hungry in April, people are hungry in August, people are hungry in September. I think it's wonderful that people think about it now, but I'd really love to see them think about it every day of the year. And hunger in America looks different. First of all, there are almost 50 million Americans hungry. That means out of the six homes on your street, one of them has hunger in their house, and it looks different. It's the mom who waters down the milk to make it last longer. It's the dad who skips a meal or two so that his children can eat. It's the child who never gets a second helping because there's not enough food to go around. And it's somewhat masked in our obesity epidemic here in this country because people think, well, everyone's overweight, so we must not have a hunger problem. Well, that's more of a nutrition problem. That's more of a what types of food we're eating. And we need to think about those that are hungry all year long.
So what's the best way to help out now and around the year?
Well, I think the best way to help out is to make a financial donation. What most people don't realize is that food banks have 4 to 6 times the buying power that an individual does. You know, a lot of us last weekend when we were shopping for our holiday meal thought, well, I'll buy an extra turkey or I'll buy an extra meal, you know, some fixings. I'll buy the stuffing and the green beans and all that, and I'll donate it to my favorite food pantry or food bank. And that's great. And I wouldn't discourage that if that's what you want to do with your family, especially your young children, to teach them. But really, that $40 or $50 that you spent in the store, if you had made that a financial donation, the food bank would have been able to buy 4 to 6 times that amount of food. So you think a $50 donation would mean $200 to $300 worth of food because of their relationships with food vendors and distributors and food manufacturers. So if you're inclined to donate food, I always say donate the food that you like. Don't clean out your pantry of the things you don't like or you aren't going to eat or you don't know what to do with, because most likely that the people receiving it aren't going to like it, aren't going to know what to do with it either. So donate things that you like, that you think others like. Protein is really needed in the food bank. So peanut butter, tuna fish, beef jerky, thinking about protein items as well as fruits and vegetables. I love recommending fresh fruits and vegetables, especially at this time of year. Food banks have gotten smarter. They've got refrigerators and freezers, and they know how to handle the food. But canned will also work to donate those types of items. And if you're not inclined to go and do that, you know, in the shopping melee that's going to take place tomorrow, make a financial contribution. FeedingAmerica.org is the parent organization of more than 200 food banks. Every county in this country is covered. And if you go to feedingamerica.org, put in your zip code, put in your state, your local food bank will come up.
We're talking to Lisa Dietlin about holiday giving and being a philanthropist all year round. And we're taking your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Who do you like to give money to? Is there an organization you do philanthropic work with? A Rotary, a Kiwanis, that sort of thing? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. We've got Mike in Burlington on the line. Mike, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I'm a member of a ham radio club.
All right.
And we do volunteer weather spotting for the National Weather Service. We also supply communications support for a lot of big gatherings like the Wisconsin Marathon, the Fall Color Festival mountain bike race, the Walworth County Get Fit 5K in spring. And we also do a thing called Kids Day in January to get kids to know a little bit about ham radio.
All right. And, Mike, I got to know before I let you go, what's your call sign?
NX9A, November X-ray 9 Alpha.
Is it on your license plate? That's what my dad does. He's a ham radio guy. All right. Mike, thank you so much. So what a great thing, Lisa,
Mike.
Combining his hobby with charitable work there, with service work.
I think that is just the best way to go about it. If you are really passionate about something, if you can incorporate a charitable part of it, that is wonderful. And so thank you, Mike, so much for what you do to give back. And that's another thing. You know, on Thanksgiving, we are worried about the retail folks at the Walmarts and the Kmarts having to work on Thanksgiving. But think about the first responders, the policemen and the firemen that are always working on these holidays, the hospital workers. Perhaps there's something you could do for them. Perhaps there's some way that you could give back in your community to your first responders that Mike is helping through communication, but perhaps you can find a way to help too.
Mike, thank you so much. And now Jan is with us in Amherst. Jan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I got my inspiration for giving from my yoga instructor. In the summer, she teaches yoga right by her lake. And just to request a minimum donation, and at the end of the year, she donates all the money to Children's Network. And that got me to thinking, well, you know, what are my gifts and how can I make that happen? So I know how to sew. So whenever anybody asks me to alter something, I charge $10 an hour. It goes to my favorite charity. And right now I'm making salted wool mittens and the proceeds will go to my favorite charity. So, you know, at this time, not all of us have a lot of extra cash to give to people or give to places, but think about what your gifts are and how you might use those to raise money in your small way.
Jan, thank you so much. Thanks for what you're doing, first of all, and thanks for calling in. Again, Lisa, somebody doing what she loves and finding out a way to help charity at the same time.
I applaud you, Jan. Thank you so much for doing that. I know a couple that live in the hardwoods in northeast Michigan, and they harvest, you know, the sap from the trees and make maple syrup. And every year they pick a charity. And when you come to purchase the maple syrup to get a quart or a pint of maple syrup, they have you actually make your payment out, or they collect the cash for that local charity. So I just love these examples, whether it's Mike, whether it's Jan, whether it's my friends in Northeast Michigan, using things that are right at their disposal. You know, and if you don't have a talent or you think, gosh, I don't have, there's nothing I do. You know, I'm a financial advisor, or I work as an accountant. I don't know how I could give back. There's many ways, and we could talk about those. But the other thing you could also do is, you know, collect a jar all year long of your loose change. And at the end of the year, donate that to your favorite charity. All of us have loose change, you know, when we go to the store. Just set a special jar aside, and at the end of the year, that could be your charitable contribution.
Great. And I noticed online, it's people are coming together. I've seen big donations made by Harry Potter fan clubs. I've made donations through board game fans. I'm a big nerd in that way. And these affinity groups, I guess, are getting together and saying, hey, what can we do to give back? Is that a trend you're seeing?
It is. People are coming together. We call them in the philanthropy world giving circles, where people come together either formally or informally and pool their resources and say, okay, what can we do? And it's not about how much each person can give. It's about everybody participating. You know, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts sometimes. And in this case, the whole would be, meaning whatever the financial end up being the contribution, other than this person gave 20, this person was able to do 10, this person was able to give 5. Well, in the end, it's $35. It's $35 towards something that otherwise you wouldn't have had the opportunity to come together and choose and have a discussion. You know, one of the things I always say about hunger at this particular meal at Thanksgiving, and some people may have already had their meal, and some people might be having family all together all weekend, but I say set an empty plate at the table. Set an empty plate for the person who doesn't have a meal today and have a discussion around the table. Start the discussion about how we should give back, why we should give back, and what's important, and about hunger in our country, or ways that we could use our talent, how people end up in a situation where they might not know where their next meal is coming from. Just starting the conversation, Rob, will change people's hearts and directions, and people will get involved.
Another caller now, Linda in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. I'm low income, and I work long hours during the week, and the weekends are for me to get errands done, but whenever I can, I donate blood to the Red Cross, and that way I'm giving something that's needed, but it doesn't cost me anything extra in time or money, and I can do it all year round.
Linda, thank you so much, and you're inspiring me. I'm way overdue for my donation. And Lisa,
me too.
We are almost out of time, and I didn't want to get away without a mention of Giving Tuesday. Just in a minute or so, what is Giving Tuesday?
Giving Tuesday is an effort by the philanthropic world to coalesce around this holiday weekend, this shopping weekend. You know, we have Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, and for the second year in a row, Giving Tuesday. And many organizations participated last year. It's an inaugural year. Many more are participating this year. And it's an effort to say, all right, we have a big shopping day for all the major retailers. We have small business shopping day. We have online. Why don't we make there be one day, the first Tuesday following Black Friday in December, November, and have all the charities raise as much money as they can. And many raise a lot more money online in that single day than they did the rest of the month on any day. So I really encourage people to look at your favorite nonprofit. They've got some amazing things going on. There's a couple that I know are releasing apps, and you can download the app and watch fun videos, and they've got deals with different vendors, and it's really unique, and it's taking off like wildfire. So check your favorite nonprofit, what they're doing on Giving Tuesday.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving. Have a great meal now. That was Lisa Dietland, philanthropy expert and author of Making a Difference, 365 Tips, Ideas, and Stories to Change Your World. Coming up, what makes a great leader? It's virtue, our next guest says. That's coming up after the news. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's not just Thanksgiving, it's Hanukkah, and we'll hear about the uniquely American approach to the holiday. First, what does it take to be a good leader? Is it an inborn talent, a skill we can acquire, or something deeper? Al Genie has been thinking about those questions. He's a professor of business ethics and chair of the management department at Loyola University Chicago. He's co-author of 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders, Leadership, and Character. Al, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
But when I think of leadership, if I think of it at all, I think of it as like a set of skills or maybe a personality style. You say it's a matter of character and virtue. Why?
Well, it's actually fundamentally about that, and I want to come back to that. When you ask anybody what's a leader or who are your favorite leaders, they'll come up with kind of an obvious group of people or even a divergent group of people, but they'll all be somewhat different in demeanor and talent and temperament. And I think there's no one specific definition of leader. Of leadership. I don't think there's one specific leader or one specific leader model that, you know, takes care of every possibility. But rather, I think, and there won't no series of attributes that are absolutely there, but rather I think that at the bottom, at the foundation of leadership, there's something you have to call character and something we want to call stewardship. That is, why are you a leader? What do you believe in and why are you a leader? And secondly, why are you leading the way you are leading? That is, what is your real job? And I think how people answer that is the foundation for leadership. And then everything else depends not on a definition, but rather a variable formula.
So by the time we're grown-ups and we're getting into leadership positions, is it possible to change our character and develop the virtues we're going to talk about, or are we locked in? It's too late.
Well, you know, character from the Greek is, you know, characteros, but it's about the etchings that are marked on us and like in stone. But now, modern psychology and I think modern philosophy suggest that there's also the learned character, the acquired character. But character, I mean what you value, what you believe in, what you're willing to act on, what empowers you, what brings you into the world. Eleanor Roosevelt said it best, you want to know a person's character, check their checkbook. How do they spend their money? Mm. What do they do? And I think character, like so much that we do in life, we expand, we develop. But after a certain point, I think there becomes this fixed nexus, this fixed, you know, center post that we call character. And that's how we judge people. That's how we decide if someone is a friend. That's how we decide if this person is a lover. That's how we decide if we really care about our family. What do they believe in, and how do they act it out?
When people are taught to be managers or leaders, whether at an MBA school or in a leadership seminar, is what you're talking about what they're getting, or is it a set of tactics?
Well, you know, if you go around to go around the country and look at the leadership courses in MBA programs, you'll find every difference possible. And you get a lot of OD stuff, organizational development. What do you do when three employees come in and one is claiming unfair practice, so on and so forth? And I call that kind of management manipulation. How do you handle that best in that circumstance? If you take my advanced course in leadership, it starts with the first book written on leadership, which is Plato's Republic, you know, and the pursuit of justice and how do you organize a state. So I think there are theoretical models by handling it, and there are also mechanical, more behavior modification models. But both are necessary. Nobody wants, I'm reading Wilson's book right now. Wilson was a student of leadership. I'm reading Wilson's biography, excuse me. But Wilson also believed that leadership can't simply be a series of, ideological statements. It has to be lived out amongst others for it to be real.
The core of your book is looking at virtues and how to develop them and role models to look to. Why do you think it was important to look for historical role models historical and present day, I should say?
Yeah. Aristotle said we really don't learn virtue by reading a treatise on ethics. We learn virtue by the witness of others. We learn virtue by how other people behave. Garrison Keillor on these airwaves said years ago that if you want your children not to smoke, not to drink, and not to eat meat, you have two alternatives. You don't smoke, eat meat and you don't drink, or you do smoke, you do eat meat. You know, one way or another, they'll react to it, and I think that's true. So I think we've always held up these wonderful leaders. And so this book, in some sense, is about characters with character. But having said that, perhaps the best contribution that this book makes of, you know, the 20,000-plus books out there on leadership is we talk about the importance of studying bad leaders as well. Because not to study bad leaders is to be vulnerable to their tactics and their strategy. Not to study bad leaders is like going to medical school that only teaches health but never touches on disease.
I want to get into the good leaders in a minute and the virtues. Who's a bad leader? Who's a cautionary example? Give us one or two.
Well, in the modern world right now, I mean, the players at Enron are a classic example. And I thought Enron would be the benchmark forever. Jeff Skillings and the organizer of the place as well. And I'm blanking on his name right now. Please forgive me. That whole cadre of people who, if you see the film, Smartest Guys in the Room, you see these men talking about the manipulation of others for self-aggrandizement and self-wealth. They, to me, were the worst kinds of misleaders. And then suddenly Bernie Madoff shows up, this nice little guy who in one part of his life runs a reputable firm and another part of his life manages about 1,500 people and misplaces about $62 billion along the way. I'm afraid that the list would go on much longer than the list of good leaders if we had time.
Well, the examples you just gave point me toward the last of the 10 virtues, at least in the order you present them in the book, deep selflessness. That sounds like it was lacking among Ken Lay and the others at Enron. Talk about selflessness as an important virtue.
I think that that's what we really mean by character, that outstanding leaders are not selfish. That is, they are not concerned about self, but they are not selfish. That their primary role and how they see themselves is in service to others. That once you become a leader, your life has now changed. You are not, as St. Augustine said, the first and the last rule of leadership is the well-being of those that they lead. And I think that selflessness does not mean that you don't care about yourself. Any parent knows you have to take care of yourself in order to take care of your children. And children are, in some sense, those people we lead. And let's forget all the particular domestic problems that come up along the way about cars, milk, and what you're eating right now. But rather, you give up a part of your life in having children, or you should, I think. And I think that anyone who runs for office is saying, I'm willing to do this for the greater good. This is a republic in the classic sense, that we elect people to be our servants. I loved what Harry Truman said when he gave up the presidency. I return to what Jefferson announced as a higher calling, a higher title, Mr. Citizen.
But that's a paradox, it seems like, because if somebody wanted to come up with a personality profile of someone who sought power and a leadership role, it seems like self-aggrandizement and self-advancement would be one of their core values.
But that's a norm that doesn't make it right. In point of fact, that's what we want to suggest. There's nothing wrong with ambition. You know, John Adams said, I am ambitious to be successful in freedom so that my children need not worry about freedom as a gift of life, okay? Ambition is a good thing. I want to be, in fact, that wonderful film Patton. Remember, they're sitting, they're being pinned down. It's George Patton and Bradley. And they're sitting down there, and Bradley says to Patton, Georgie, you do this because you love it. I do it because I'm trained to do it, and somebody's got to. That's who I want to hire, not George Patton for all of his bravado and success and technique and competence. I want Omar Bradley, who did it because it was a task to be done. And I think that we have simply been, if I'm talking too much, make me stop, we've simply been, to accept ambition as narcissism. No, I want to be a good teacher because my students deserve it. I want to be a good surgeon because my patients deserve it. That's ambitious ambition that I think is righteous.
And your illustrative example for deep selflessness in your book is Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, and in retrospect, we should have made it a double characteristic at the end, and that should have been Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela in a very real sense. Martin Luther King Jr. was not a man without his own peculiar personal failures. He was a man who liked a Baptist minister who liked to drink and liked to smoke and liked clothes, and by his own admission and by his wife's admission, was not totally faithful during the course of his marriage. But putting that aside, at the age of 27 years old, you know, he became the leader of a movement that he had no desire to be in. But once he was there, he realized that it was his responsibility, and he dedicated his life to it. Now, I think we're both old enough to remember that Martin Luther King was not the only leader of the black movement, the civil rights movement at the time, that he was not universally always loved on every issue. But he drove civil rights in a way that it would never be driven before, and in a way that it would not be stopped. Having said that, when he was shot on that balcony in Atlanta, it halted the movement, but it did not destroy it. And I think Nelson Mandela, who's still with us at 95 years of age, is my hero of heroes. He is Africa's Lincoln, although both men are clouded by mystery and mystique and, you know, a kind of iconic folklore. He referred to 27 years in prison as the University of Life. He went in a terrorist and a rebel. He came out a Gandhian pacifist and a Democrat. There's something magnificent about that transition, and both men, that I should be lauded.
We're talking to Al Jeaney about leadership and character. He's co-author of the book 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders. We'll pick up the conversation after a quick check of the headlines. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We're talking about great leadership with Al Jeaney. He's co-author of 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders. He's also a professor of business ethics and chair of the management department at Loyola University Chicago. Al, I wanted to get into some more of the virtues you talk about. Let's go with the first one, deep honesty. How does that work, and why is it an important virtue for a leader?
Can I back up and say the 10 we've listed are 10 that we think are kind of critical, but there are others as well. When you understand virtue to be a habit, a chosen behavior that advances the good life, that lets us live better with others, we think that these 10 are kind of sine qua non, you know, basic. But of course there would be others, but one has to limit one's realm. Well, deep honesty, you know, that's part of almost the selflessness. I think that we have to avoid deception. We have to avoid misinterpretation. What a concept, you know, honesty and advertisement. I think deep honesty is about trust, transparency, and being willing not to deceive in an intentional manner. That doesn't mean you answer every question, but it does mean sometimes you say, as a leader, no comment, I'm not sure, I'll get back to you. That's not a weakness. Rather, that's a clarification and an invitation to ask me again when I know.
And the example you give there, James Burke.
Yeah, the famous Tylenol, and part of that Tylenol happened right here in Chicago. Tylenol happened not far from where I'm speaking right now, where when 7 people went down with what was considered now random urban terrorism, cyanide put into Tylenol. And Burke came in there and said, we're through. You know, everyone said, you're through. This is done. Close this down. Tylenol is over. Johnson & Johnson is big enough. And he said, no, we got to find out what's going on here. We have an obligation to our stakeholders, to the people we work with, the people we work for, and the people we come to work to serve. We got to find out what happened here. It's not enough to just avoid liability or pay this off. We want to understand what went wrong. And so even though he could have taken the easy way, he did the right thing for the right reason on purpose. He examined everything at the Tylenol end. He did all reparations possible for the victims at the time. And ironically, at the end, 10 years later, they received about a $50 million settlement because there should have been some preparation for it, but it was a technicality. But I think James Burke wound up being the good guy here because he was trying to be helpful. He wasn't simply trying to CYA, a term from Vietnam, which I'm sure the audience is aware of. He was trying rather to be honest, be open, and tell the truth.
Well, and that would be the gut instinct a lot of the time, cover your rear end and lawyer up.
Right, right. You know, Mark Twain once said, when in a difficult situation, tell the truth. It'll befuddle your enemies and surprise your friends. But I think there's something absolutely correct about that. And, you know, deep honesty is really about truth. And when I tell my students, when I ask my business students, what's the word fiduciary mean? Well, they say, money responsibility, you know, money obligations. I said, no, not at all. It isn't financial. It starts with an F. It's from fidere, the Latin for truthfulness. That's why dogs used to be called Fido. To be truthful, to be dependable. That's really the bond between business, the bond between lovers, the bond between friends, that you can trust me, that I will be faithful to our relationship. Infidelity in marriage is not about having sex with another, but rather by being unfaithful, emotionally unfaithful in regard to truth with another, which would include sex, but not the only issue.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Scott with us in Iron River. Hi there, Scott.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with political leadership. It seems that politics has always been divisive, but at least in the past, there have been leaders that have worked to get along, and it's very frustrating nowadays to see that politics seems to have disintegrated into let's see, you know, how bad we can make the other side or the other person look, and so forth. And just appreciate your comments on what we need to get things turned around. Thank you very much.
I can't answer the last part, but I think that the caller is absolutely correct. But first of all, let's back up. I think politics is always adversarial. And I think, by the way, within a democracy, that's the point, that you have different points of view, that adversary doesn't mean hatred, enemy. It means debate and discussion. If you look back in history, Washington and John Adams had horrible times with Congress. So did, you know, Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson. And certainly in the Civil War, there were so many different cliques in Congress. Lincoln was hamstrung left, right, and sideways. But I think what's happened in the modern age, there used to be a time when senators all lived in Washington. There used to be a time when congressmen knew each other and recreated with each other, in which they were the loyal opposition because they had to live there. Now they're always gone. I think what's happened now is kind of niche politics, that it's totally adversarial in this sense. If you've got power, instead of the loyal opposition to help correct and manage, our job is to take over that power. And I think that was really came to bear with the Clinton administration. They wanted Clinton out. Now, I'm not saying that Mr. Clinton wasn't guilty of a couple of unfortunate incidents. But the point is, it became as if you're not there. When Jimmy Carter won this thing, it was like, why are you there? We want that from you. So I think adversary has now become opponent for power rather than adversary for the people.
Let's talk about one of the political leaders you use as an example in your book, Winston Churchill, in your chapter on moral judgment and moral vision.
And we chose Churchill can be used, you know, Winston Churchill, fill in the blank. You know, what do you want to say about him? He's one of those characters, right? But we wanted to use him for moral vision because of Churchill's tenacity. Churchill, you know, Churchill, by the time Hitler was coming around in 1933, was a backbencher. You know, he had been guilty of Gallipoli and the war. He had served marvelously in the war. He had been in the cabinet, so on and so forth. But now he's a backbencher, an old guy, drank a lot of alcohol and wrote a lot of books that nobody read. But he was still in Parliament and still paying attention, and he kept saying, this Nazi guy is not just another leader. He's not just the new guy on the block in Germany that's going to help Germany get out of its depression. And you got to remember, 1939, both FDR and Adolf Hitler were 6 years in office and had taken their countries out of the depression, and in 1939, Hitler was Man of the Year for Time magazine. He kept saying, this is evil. This man is evil. I've read Mein Kampf. I've had it translated. I read one of the first translations. I've read the news reports. I've talked to journalists. This is evil. This is a clash of civilizations. Unless we prepare ourselves for this, we'll be doomed and damned. He was right, and he kept saying that. And it's only by his tenacity that, in some sense, Chamberlain was put out of office, and a real defense of England began. And happily, Dunkirk didn't happen on the negative side, and Churchill immediately went to America and said to FDR, this is going to happen to us unless you're involved in this as well. And those two men plotted the salvation of the world.
A couple more examples I wanted to get into. Aesthetic sensitivity as a virtue of a leader. That's a different one.
Yeah, that is totally different. And my colleague Ron Green, who is this wonderful, it was such a pleasure writing with a dear friend, and we're still friends, how about that, and planning other books. We wanted to talk about a sense of sensitivity. You know, everyone talks about intellectual excellence, and certainly, you know, when we talk about politics, you're talking about Jefferson and FDR and even JFK, this hunger, this openness to, you know, new knowledge. But also aesthetic sensitivities. And I think Steve Jobs didn't create the computer. He created a beautiful computer. He created a beautiful way of learning. He changed how we learn, what we learn, what's available to us, even if you know people have planned on that. And I think, as Daniel Pink talks about, we don't just make products. We have to make beautiful products. As someone once said, oh, the gentleman at General Motors said, we're not in the car business. We're in the business of design, and we just happen to have what we design as things that take us around. I think that beauty is part of our lives, and I think it's a feature of our lives, and I think that that has to be brought into us as well. You know, we have a mayor that is now gone, Mayor Daley in Chicago. Oh, I'm sure he's going to be castigated here, there, and everywhere for a while. You know how that goes. But he made Chicago beautiful, and he'll always be remembered for that. And I think that's a part of leadership.
One more I wanted to get to, the idea of compassion and care as a virtue as exemplified by Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, another strange one, because here's what we're committed to, and then we'll bring in Oprah to not as a defense, but as an example. I think leaders have to be emotionally connected to their leadership, that is, to those they lead. I think there has to be a human connection. Woodrow Wilson, again, in the book, what I'm finding wonderful about reading this Woodrow Wilson book is he is not this automaton we now see in the old films and, you know, the pictures where he's kind of stiff as a board, this Presbyterian guy from Princeton, you know, professor from Princeton. He ends up being a completely passionate human being who loved his wives, chased his second wife around the White House, if you will, figuratively and literally, a real human being. But one of his problems was, and when he went out on the stump, people knew that. But he had to get out there all the time. You need a leader, and certainly the modern press, the modern media, you know, the most photographed man in the world every single day is, you know, the President of the United States, both by law and by tradition now. You need someone who resonates with others. And in a very real sense, Oprah Winfrey's success is based on her being able to resonate with an audience and creating not simply an audience, but a followership. When her show was on, 44 million people a week watched it. My mother would rather have shot her foot off than miss it, right? And what she created was a pool of people who were not dependent upon her, but looked to her for something. That's still leadership. She changed culture. She changed what we read and how we read. She changed many people's lives in different ways. And I think that was kind of a stretch, but in a very real sense, her success is built on the fact that people really believed that she liked them.
Thanks so much for joining us, Al. That was Al Genie, professor of business ethics and chair of the management department at Loyola University of Chicago. He's co-author of 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders, Leadership and Character. Hey, maybe you're stumbling across our show Central Time for the first time. This isn't part of your usual schedule. We are also on non-holidays, every weekday from 3 to 6, in fact. And you can check us out. You can listen on your radio, on your computer, on your tablet, or on your smartphone with the WPR app. You can get that at WPR.org. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll track the news of the day. Michael Leland, our news director, is going to bring us up to date on the latest political stories from around Wisconsin. And we've got an expert photographer on board, tips for taking the best photos. Maybe you could have used those today on the holidays. Well, don't worry. You'll get another chance over the weekend. Still to come here on Central Time, it's not just Thanksgiving. It's the first day of Hanukkah. And we'll talk about the uniquely American traditions that have grown up around the holiday. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.